Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about, apparently, movies and wine.
It's about movies and wine.
Yes. Yes,
it is. Thank you, social media voters.
For those of you who don't know shit about one or both of those topics, my name is Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I am Scott. I'm the movie guy. And we are here to help. Each episode, we recommend a movie that I love and a wine that he loves.
We'll tell you and each other why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find that the pairing works. Sometimes we don't. This is part two of our discussion about Ann Hill Farm's Sonoma Coast Pinot Noir and Little Women.
That's right. We ran way crazy mad long in our recording session for this one, but unfortunately, being the raving egomaniacs that we are, we actually think that all 4.5 hours of that was actually pretty good, so we don't want to deprive you of any sweet, sweet, delicious content from the trough. So here's part two. We're picking up a conversation already in progress.
Enjoy, y'all.
All right, so I just talked for a while. You need to transition us into youthful. I'm tired of coming up with the transitions.
It was a very good transition that you did.
You're welcome.
It was a very funny way to get me to introduce the next pairing word, which is youthful. So this is the word about which I have kind of the least to say. When it comes to this wine, it is a young wine. This is the vintage 2019, and it is made by young men. These are young, energetic people making this wine. There's a quote from Webster Marquez. It's a good thing we're young and don't need much sleep, which is a nod to the fact that they're running the production of these wines, which is pretty complex considering they're doing five or so single vineyards plus two Appalachian wines plus a Chardonnay and a Syrah, depending on the year. And they also, with the exception of Anthony now, have their own full-time jobs. It takes a lot of energy to get these wines made because these people got to live.
They got to hustle.
They got to hustle.
They got to work. They got to go to New York and sell their short stories to Tracy Letts and compromise morally and aesthetically.
Well, I mean, and they also do sometimes have to go to New York and sell their wine because market visits are a part of any winemaker's life.
They don't have like somebody, they don't have like a sales rep who does that for them. I guess
definitely
some vineyards
not
do, right?
Ann Hill Farms. I'm sure that Papa Pietro Perry has a sales manager.
Papa Pietro Perry.
I'm going to need to now track down some bottles of that wine that we've said the name of the winery enough times.
And that's Papa Pietro Perry?
Papa Pietro Perry Winery, yes.
Is it wrong that anytime I hear or think or invoke Papa Oo Mau Mau, I think of Happy Feet 2?
A movie which I have not seen.
Oh my God, Jamie. You're a fucking broken record. She's going to get a little sound effect button here on the recorder.
So am I just going to, now I have to just start naming wines that you've never tasted.
Which would be?
All of them.
All but 20 of them.
All of them.
Yeah.
And you don't even remember all 20 that you've tasted.
I think if you were to name a bunch of wines, I could pretty accurately pick out the ones that we have drank and that I have typed the words before.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure that Papa Pietro Perry Winery has its own sales team and market manager and all of that. But even with wineries that have a sales team, winemaker market visits are necessary, particularly to the New York market, it being the largest wine market out there.
What is a wine market like? Is this like one of the things you've described before, like a bunch of purple tooth psalms get together and drink 500 wines?
That's a tasting, a portfolio tasting.
Okay.
When I say the market, like the Philadelphia market or the New York market or whatever, I'm not talking about a place where people are hawking wine.
No, I understand, but they have to go to a thing for a reason. What is the thing that they're going to and what do they do when they go there?
They're going to the city and they're visiting key accounts.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So like they're visiting with psalms and chefs and stuff.
Correct.
At like big buying restaurants.
Usually what happens for a winemaker visiting whatever town, they will have a schedule of certain key accounts that they visit individually, and they'll usually schedule maybe an industry lunch where a number of different buyers will be invited to taste all of the wines together at some such restaurant. And then they'll do a winemaker dinner for consumers at a different restaurant. So you're sort of covering the buyers and then doing an event for your higher end consumers. It sounds pretty exhausting. it also sounds kind of fun because you just like come into town, get driven around by a sales rep, talk about your stuff, move on. And then at the end of the day, you have a big dinner where you're the center of attention and you talk about yourself. And that sounds appealing to me because I love being in the center of attention.
Oh my God, guys. I'm sure everyone listening can hear the shit-eating grin that came on Jamie's face when he said the words, talk about yourself. He got so, so excited.
That being said, most winemakers don't like talking about themselves that much. They tend to be like, they're back of the house people. They like to be in the cellar making the wine and not being bothered by humans.
Right.
Generally speaking.
Well, they have a shred of humility and shame that you have lacked your entire adult
life. My entire life.
That's true.
I never had it even as a child.
I am aware.
So the winemakers are youthful, but the wine, it's a young wine. And I mentioned to you off mic, I consider this wine to be both a sprinter and a marathon runner, by which I mean it shows really well young. I think it's very exuberant. That red rose note is very, very enchanting. There's nothing about it that seems closed.
What does that mean?
It's not muted in any way. All of the flavors are showing themselves fully. It's great right now. But I also think that this wine will age well, and that's the marathon part of it. Give it 20 or 40 years, and this is more for the next pairing word than it is for this one, but give it some time, and it's going to be a beautiful old wine.
All right, so we'll come back to that when we get to our next pairing word, but I wanted to circle back on something.
Yes.
You said that Ant Hill bottles 7 different Pinot Noirs.
Yes.
At the risk of betraying my ignorance and...
Oh, do risk it.
Yeah. Thank you for your blessing. Why? How different are they? I'm guessing some of them are prestige worldwide and some of them are tradition bottlings and some of them are for aging and some of them are single vineyard.
You're talking about the past things that we've talked about. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Correct. So when I say appellation wine, what I mean is it's a wine that's designated only by its appellation. This is the Sonoma Coast wine and then there's the North Coast wine. The other wines that are single vineyards, while they do have appellations, it's the single vineyard part that is important.
I see. So it's just about like specificity.
Correct.
Okay. So appellation can be anywhere from that region.
Right.
Which is actually a useful word that has meaning that doesn't change depending on who you ask. But the single vineyard is just from like the one place where these grapes are grown in this farm.
Yep. That's correct. And the conditions at that particular place affect how the finished wine tastes. The conditions can range from like microclimatic events like hail in the vineyard that is like centralized on one location. And this happened in the Finger Lakes in 2020. The Gewürztraminer vineyard that Red Newt sources from got basically decimated and they got like a third of a ton of Gewürztraminer in 2020, where normally they get like 1.5 tons.
Decimated by what? By fire?
By hail.
By hail.
Yeah.
You said microclimate events and I felt.
And you blacked out.
No, I just felt my butthole clench up because that's what I just feel is just the growing panic at all times. Like I live in fucking basically rural Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and now I get tornado warnings twice a week.
And it's
fucking microclimate events.
Right. Something that affects just a small area.
Yeah.
So you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Right. But it also made me afraid.
It can range from things like that to just simple differences in the way the vineyard is oriented. Like if it's on an east-facing slope, it catches the sun in a different way than if it's on a west or north or south-facing slope.
And that does things to sugar and flavor and fermentation and changes stuff.
I could talk for a long time about like the specifics, and there are people who would be better qualified to talk for an even longer time about those specifics. But
I can't imagine anyone better qualified than you to talk about this.
I appreciate that.
You know what? That sounded pretty sarcastic, and it was. So I'm gonna try that again. We're gonna keep rolling, and this is part of the canon of the show. Jamie, I genuinely cannot imagine a better communicator about these things than you. I have had more than one friend reach out to me and be like, hey, like, I like the show and it's objectively about movies and wine and movies are definitely the more important part, Scott, and I want you to know that. But Jamie really unpretentiously demystifies wine and makes it approachable and makes me feel not scared when I go to the wine store.
That's a big compliment. Thank you.
You're doing good work.
I appreciate the compliment despite all of the backhanded everything leading up to it.
I can only be me.
That is 100% true, as has been demonstrated over the 25 years we've known each other.
Would that it were some other way, but I can only be me.
Where the fuck was I?
I have no idea.
The orientation of the vineyards,
right.
The placement of the vineyards, if they're closer to the ocean or farther inland, if they're farther north or farther south, like these are things that affect how the grapes behave. Then you talk about clonal material. What specific clone of the grape is planted there, or how the vine rows are oriented, or the vine spacing. All of these things, these really granular specific things, contribute to the flavor of the final wine, which can be quite different bottle to bottle of these single vineyard wines.
All right. I'm down with that. I will allow the fine trio of gentlemen at Ant Hill Farms to continue making 7 different wines, all made from the same grape.
You hear that, Ant Hill Farms? Scott Hudson allows it.
I approve. I think you should continue. I don't understand why you're doing what you're doing, but I've heard a compelling argument. Keep making 7 different products that are ostensibly the same, but charging different prices and putting different labels on them.
But the single vineyards are largely the same. Like, they range from like $38 to $45. No crazy variation there, but they are more expensive than the Appalachian wines.
And this is an Appalachian because it's Sonoma Coast.
Correct.
And not
the Tina Marie vineyard, which they don't make anymore, but I really loved that wine.
What did it taste like? Did it taste like Pinot Noir?
Yes, it tasted like Pinot Noir.
And the grape was?
Pinot Noir.
And it's still from the Sonoma Coast of California. And it's still
it was actually a Russian River wine.
Well, I mean, that's a whole nother ballgame now. I mean, the difference between Russian River and Sonoma Coast is, I mean.
Honey, just stop it.
You
just
know. Stop it. I don't need to tell you.
Put it down. So, Scott.
The youth.
Obviously, there is literal youth on display, but I'm sure that you've got more thoughts.
About the youthfulness?
About the youthfulness of this movie.
Of the low women? I just have like this quick list of things that inflect it. And then we should just talk about, because we've talked about the form and the intellect and the construction and the camera and all of that stuff. But like, there's so much joy in this movie and we haven't really talked about it.
We haven't talked about the joy at all.
Yeah.
So lead us into the joy.
There is an energy and a vibrance and an enthusiasm that comes especially in the past sections when they are all young women or when they are all girls. Here are the many ways that director Greta Gerwig accomplished that. Maybe the most enjoyable scene in the entire movie, which is the first time Joe meets Laurie and they're dancing on that like porch outside of the party. The dance is great and it's thrilling and everybody inside the party is dancing to like a chamber music ensemble, right? The dancing that the two of them are performing it's like one of the few real anachronisms in the movie. Like children just didn't dance that way back then. We assume there's a more formality to it, right?
Right.
She played David Bowie on set for the two of them. And it still wasn't an improvised dance. Like they played David Bowie and they choreographed what their dance was going to be to a Bowie song, which was then played back on set for them. And that fucking scene is magic.
Yep.
Like,
it really is.
Just briefly, the two of them have off the charts bananagrams chemistry.
Incredible chemistry. It's leaping out of the screen.
Yeah. Gerwig described the two of them as formidable actors, and I think she's absolutely correct. And Saoirse Ronan has always been great, and...
Saoirse, like inertia,
has always been great, even when she was a small child. I think she was like 14 when she broke out in Atonement, and she's unbelievable in that movie. And she's been great in everything that she's ever been in since then. And then Timmy Cham Cham is just like...
Can I ask you, where does Timmy Cham Cham come from?
It comes from Parks and Recreation.
Okay.
You've watched Parks and Recreation?
Not the whole run.
Okay. So it's like, not that anyone says Timmy Cham Cham, but you know how like I like to internalize like jokey ways of saying things that are dumb.
Yes.
And silly. Well, it's when your casting call in that show, Tom Haverford is talking about the ways that he describes food. I call desserts, zerts, and I call appetizers, apps, and I call chicken parm, chicky parm parm. And that is where Timmy Cham Cham came from.
Okay. Got it. So you were saying Timmy Cham Cham.
Their chemistry is off the charts. I love the way that they dance. I love the way that she hits him all the time.
Yep.
Like whenever he annoys her, she just comes up and fucking wails on him in the shoulder, which is not a thing in the book. Like for as much as it's a very, very faithful adaptation of the text, like Joe is not wailing on Laurie at all in the text, but it just feels perfect. And it just feels like something that came out of rehearsal or just out of the two of them and their like natural camaraderie on screen. This is something else that lends to the youthfulness and that sense of like authentic and like exuberant youth is that Greta Gerwig fought and got 2 weeks of rehearsal time, which is like, you think that that would be commonplace, and it's increasingly rare to see or to hear that there was actual rehearsal for the movie. There's just not fucking time. It's expensive to have people on payroll for an extra 2 weeks, especially if you want to rehearse in the locations. But you can really feel it in those scenes with the four girls together, where the sense of family and sisterhood and the way that they always interrupt and overlap each other and the bouncing off of each other, that doesn't happen accidentally, even with great actors. Like you have to figure that shit out. And I feel like the rehearsal really leads to that. Gerwig was asked in Q&A, she's told this story, I think I heard it on the Filmmaker Toolkit podcast, somebody asked her in a Q&A, like, why did you update the dialogue to something more contemporary? And she said, I didn't, I just had them talk faster.
Which is so cool.
And it's perfect. And it feels like, when she was talking, I mentioned before that she said that period pieces can feel very nailed down, right? They can feel like they're too sturdy and rigid, and that this one doesn't have that. And I think a lot of that is just the energy and the speed and the inflection of a lot of the dialogue, which is a lot of it, having now read it, I can like verify, it is just straight the text out of the book, which is appropriate to the period of the 1860s. But they just speak like fucking lightning fast and they interrupt each other constantly.
Constantly. It's so much fun. And yeah. It keeps that bouncy energy.
And that's not an improv thing either. That's in her script. Like she did what you would do in theater, where she uses slashes in the actual screenplay to indicate where Amy cuts off Joe in this particular exchange of dialogue. And if one of the actors flubbed it, like she would call cut and pull the actor aside and say, hey, I needed you to come in on this word and not this word. Like it's very meticulous to create something that feels very spontaneous.
I'm interested, sorry, just to backtrack quickly.
Yeah. I don't want to monologue too much.
I had a thought percolating and didn't get it out fast enough.
I could smell the percolating or maybe hear it. I guess we hear percolating.
I just think it's really interesting that rehearsal is rare. It just seems so counterintuitive to making a good product with all of the incredible amounts of money and skill and effort being expended on these things.
Yeah.
The idea that that's a thing that's okay to cut seems insane to me.
Yep.
And maybe I'm just saying a thing that you agree with for you to say yes to, but like,
yep.
Is there anything else? Like, is there a market force that made that the thing that gets cut do you have any further insight on that?
I mean, so like, and that's me generalizing, but it is something that she talked about in interviews that she had to fight to get time for rehearsal. And I just feel like I hear less and less and less that people are talking about rehearsing and more like, oh yeah, we didn't have time for rehearsals at all. If I were to talk out of my ass and speculate about it, I would say that a lot of it has to do with how the middle has evaporated from like Hollywood. So there's little tiny independent movies where they probably don't have money to, you know, because rehearsal is payroll. People have to get paid for their work. And for actors, like that's your largest like single line item on your budget normally is labor, and actors are the most expensive bit of labor that you have. So like right now, when the only movies that are coming out of Hollywood are little tiny independents that cost like maybe, I think Lady Bird costs like $10 million, which feels like a lot for a film that small, but like shit's expensive to shoot in California.
I mean, it is a lot of money, but it compared to...
Yeah, I mean, this movie cost $40 million. But yeah, the middle has disappeared. So you've got the little tiny indies. And then on the other end of the spectrum is the studios have basically hollowed themselves out. And the only thing they want to do is make potential franchise trilogy starters. And that kind of shit is super expensive. And the thing that those movies largely, to generalize, don't emphasize is performance,
right,
and chemistry and nuance, and it's, you know, everything's got to be pre-vised and you got to figure out how the effects are going to work and the marketing matters and we're going to start shooting before there's even a script. How do you fucking rehearse when
there's no script?
Right,
that's a very good point.
And the thing that doesn't exist for the most part anymore is the adult drama or the adult comedy, where like where performance and chemistry and on-screen presence is the most important thing, essentially, if you're not talking about, you know, big fireworks and effects and spectacle. And those things just don't exist. The things that are like hinged upon having good rehearsal time. And it seems sad, but then also I have to remind myself that the adult drama while it doesn't exist for the most part in this country on the big screen, has a home now, and it's called television.
Right.
Yeah. So all the things that, like, everybody, you know, we revere from, like, the 70s in particular, and like the Hollywood new golden age, those things are still getting made. They're just happening in 10-part installments on HBO and on AMC and FX. And that's where something like Rehearsal actually happens sometimes.
That's cool.
Except not so much, because it's television, and television has no time or budget for anything.
Does the adult comedy still exist anywhere?
No.
Okay.
Jimmy, comedy doesn't exist anymore.
Which, I know, I keep searching for it. I want to laugh.
There are comedies being made, but like the idea of like the studio comedy with big comedy stars, like it basically doesn't exist anymore.
Fuck that shit.
It's franchises, and it's children's films that are redressed up as franchises. And there's, you know, you have the gems of like things coming out of A24, like, but that's a boutique studio. That's a trumped up indie studio, essentially. Comedy so rarely exists. Like last year, Palm Springs, it was a huge hit on Hulu. Who knows how many people actually saw it, but like it felt like it crested the zeitgeist and everybody loved it. And I was stunned, like, oh my God, a comedy that people have seen. Like, comedies don't go to theaters anymore. They don't get made for them anymore.
I don't like it.
There's no room for it, because you can't start a $1 billion global franchise based on a comedy.
Okay. So now that I'm thoroughly depressed,
right,
we can move along with your points.
That's correct. The youth.
The youth.
The other thing with Saoirse Ronan and Timmy Cham Cham, Greta would have them constantly swap wardrobe pieces during filming.
Really?
So she liked the to play up the inherent androgyny of the two characters. Joe is a woman with a man's name, and Laurie is a man with a woman's name. And the two of them, as she described them, they are both, Saoirse Ronan and Timothy Chalamet are both beautiful and handsome together. There is an androgyny to both of them that she thought worked really well. And so she had them switching costume pieces all the time. The costuming in general, like, I'm not a person who normally gets excited about costuming, but the now Oscar-winning costume designer, Jacqueline Duran, who Greta brought on, she was the first major department head that she hired, because she knew that costuming was going to be so important in this movie. Like, the first version of the script comes through and she goes through it with a producer, and it's like, oh, there's going to be like 80 wardrobes for our 5 or 6 principal characters. Like, it all has to be perfect and it has to be nailed, but it also can't feel stuffy. It can't feel overly starched, you know? Like, if this is going to have the energy and the enthusiasm and the organic family feeling that she wanted to capture, it can't be fucking hoop skirts and corsets, right?
Right.
Most of the girls' costumes, Jacqueline Duran made as 2 pieces at least, or 2 or 3 pieces, so that the actresses themselves could come in during, not on the day of shooting, but like when they were doing wardrobe fittings, and they could mix and match different pieces. So they might have a number of pieces laid out for them and saying, this is what we're doing for this particular scene. Here's your options. And so they could come in and say, here's my skirt and here's the top, and maybe there's a vest and here's the jacket that I want to wear. And by doing that, not only do you get the actor to buy into it more, but then you get the authenticity of young actors choosing what their wardrobe is.
That's cool.
And it's like actors will tell you all the time, like, the moment you get into wardrobe, that's doing like a lot of the work for you. It just puts you in who the person is.
Right. And if you're shaping that, then it's more powerful.
Yeah. And then the last thing about youthful for me, and we talked about it a little bit, is just Florence Pugh. How is she so convincingly a child? Like, I'm kind of overwhelmed. I was really taken by it watching it again the other night. Her transformation, not just physically, like, there a lot of the wardrobe and hair and makeup is doing the physical transformation, right, for her. Her voice is in a deeper register than a lot of women. She modulates her voice up when she's a child, but there's a manic energy to child Amy. The way that she just freaks out and gets excited about things, or the way that she'll rail off, and like the way that a child gets excited about something and just kind of goes into their own brain and isn't even listening to what other people are talking about. Like, you love whimsy. There is a whimsy to that characterization.
There absolutely is. 100%.
That is just magical.
When she does the bad thing.
When she burns Joe's manuscript.
Right.
Which is a hard watch.
It's a really hard watch, but it speaks to the manic energy that you talked about. She burns it in a rage, and then manages to perform a very convincing apology. That character realized that she did a bad thing.
Interesting.
You think it was a disingenuous apology?
I don't think it's disingenuous. I think it's sincere in the way that a child knows that someone is mad at them. And yeah. She doesn't want Joe to be mad at her anymore.
But that's growing up.
That's the first step.
The first thing is, oh, I've hurt a person that I care about.
Yeah. Don't be mad at me.
I'm sorry for that. I'm sorry that I hurt you. I don't fully understand what it was that I did that hurt you or how it hurt you, but I'm sorry that you were hurt.
Some of us come to that realization later in life, Jamie. Some of us take a little while to learn how to apologize for their misdeeds.
Yes, Scott, go on.
I'm talking about me here specifically. And that it was you and certain others who taught me to apologize, not only to learn how to do it, but to learn that it needs to be done from time to time.
From time to time, and in a genuine way.
Right. Fortunately, I don't need to apologize for much these days, as I live my life without error or grievance.
But then that sequence goes on to the ice skating sequence,
right,
where she's just desperately trying to be near her sister who is still mad at her, even when she's been cast out. I mean, that's talk about youth right there.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Please stop being mad at me. Oh, you're not mad at me. I need to now attach myself to you until you are not mad at me anymore, because I'll feel the crushing weight of your anger every moment you're gone. Then Saoirse learns the lesson that she should probably forgive sooner, because at any moment, people you care about might die.
God, I love the two Dern moments. When Joe is crying and weeping over her burnt up manuscript, and Marmee is holding her and trying to calm her down, and she's like, Joe, forgive her now. Don't let the sun go down on your anger, which is a beautiful moment in the book. And you get somebody like Laura Dern to just come in and take a line that is good and elevate it, and make that line sing. And then later on, after Amy has fallen into the ice and Joe is confessing to her, basically, I was so mad at her. And if she had died, it would have been my fault. And I'm just so angry and I can't deal with my anger. And then it's another one. It's this great Laura Dern moment where she's like, I have been angry every day of my life.
Oh, God. I had forgotten about that line.
I'm getting chills now. I just love the movie so much. She just plays such a wonderful mother who is unafraid of revealing her own flaws to her children, because she knows that by revealing them, she can help them. She can help Joe out. Also, fucking masterful casting to get Saoirse Ronan and Laura Dern to play daughter and mother, who just, they have such similar faces, and they both look perfect.
They just look totally perfect, buy it. But also they're both fantastic at what they're doing, and their chemistry on screen is insanely good.
It's almost like this is an incredibly good movie that's really well cast and beautifully directed and well made. It's
almost
so good.
Almost like that.
It's so good.
We're going from youthful to timeless.
From youthful to timeless.
From youthful to timeless.
Definitely not two words that mean the same thing. No, they don't mean the
same
thing.
Not even close.
I mean, they're in the ballpark.
Are they?
They're on a spectrum.
They're on a spectrum.
Lay it on me about timeless. What is timeless about this wine that has a number on it and apparently is good for 20 to 40 years?
Okay. So I talked about it being age-worthy, and for sure, some people use the word timeless to describe a bottle of wine that will age long. And obviously I don't think that that's right. At a certain point, the wine will not be good anymore. It's not bulletproof. It won't exist forever. The 2019 vintage likely won't taste any good in 2080. You're looking at me with that face.
Well, it's just,
with that dumb face.
Who the fuck cares what a bottle of wine will taste like in 2080?
People in 2080 care.
No, they're all going to be like fucking Kevin Costner, and they're going to be trying to find ways to recycle their own urine. They're not going to care. They're not going to care at all about wine. If they find a bottle, they're going to dump all the grape juice out and use it to fucking send messages and beg people for potable water and food and to save them from the ravagers.
Aged wine is something wonderful. Some of the more transcendent wine moments of my life have been with old wines. it's a time capsule. It's A, intellectually interesting, the way that wine ages and what it tastes like when it's old. But also then looking at that label and thinking about the people that were involved in making that wine so long ago and being able to taste the literal fruits of their labor is an experience that's difficult to describe, other than there's a reverential quality to it.
Could you try a little harder to describe it?
I mean, I can describe what old wine tastes like.
Because all old wine tastes the same.
I can...
You heard it here first, everybody. All old wine. Jamie, what's the cutoff point? Is it 15 years, 20 years, at which point they just all blend together and it all just tastes like brown sugar water?
Okay, so friends of the show, when you see Scott and he has two black eyes, don't be surprised.
Yeah. But so all aged wine does not taste the same.
No, it all tastes very different. Red wine loses color as it ages. And it loses tannin. The fruit character tends to change from ripe or underripe to stewed or cooked. Secondary or tertiary flavors tend to come out, like nuttiness. The earthiness of the wine becomes more emphasized. Herbal qualities become more emphasized as well. Take Bordeaux, for example, a really dark-fruited, full-bodied, tannic wine with, you know, a touch of like a cedar box kind of note to it, as well as like some vegetal notes, might turn into a really elegant, lighter bodied, softer tanned wine that has aromas of stewed fruit and dried fruit, as well as like pencil shavings. And don't look at me like that.
Pencil shavings.
Pencil shavings.
And this is a desirable flavor.
Old Bordeaux is beautiful
because of the pencil shavings
and all of the other things about it.
Well, all right, Jamie, I'm going to ask, and you're going to unreasonably get up in arms about it, but what do pencil shavings taste like, having never eaten pencil shavings before?
You went to school in a time when you had to like manually sharpen your pencil, right?
That is correct. I did not usually take the contents of the wall-mounted pencil sharpener and shake it over my lunch.
But you smelled it.
I guess.
You can't conjure right now the smell of being in a childhood classroom. You've just left childhood entirely behind you.
Jamie, and I'm become 36. I barely remember my 20s. Like,
you're like a 70-year-old man with no memory of the joy of childhood.
I have lots of memory of the joy of childhood. My joyful memories don't usually involve sniffing the office supplies, except for some of the markers. That might be part of the problem.
That may be part of the problem. I'm dumbfounded that you can't conjure a recollection of the smell of pencil shavings in a classroom, considering it was a thing we were exposed to daily.
I could tell you what the smell of one of those pink trapezoidal-shaped erasers are like after you erase really hard and it gets warm and stanky. I couldn't tell you what pencil shavings smell like.
Okay, so sharpen a pencil and you'll know what I'm talking about.
I would have to get a pencil.
Sure. I have a pencil upstairs. I don't know that I have a pencil sharpener, actually.
Probably not. I have a pencil sharpener at home. I have colored pencils because I have a child.
That's a similar smell, but the one I'm talking about is specifically like a graphite pencil.
Like a Ticonderoga number two pencil.
Yeah, that's correct. Okay. And I know you asked me to describe it, but that's like...
It smells like pencil shavings.
It smells like fucking pencil shavings. It
smells like wood and graphite.
Wood and graphite.
Great. Pencil shavings, very appealing flavor.
One of these days, we'll drink a really great old Bordeaux together, and your memory will come rushing back to you as though you were Anton Ego in Ratatouille's, in Gusteau's, when Remy is cooking for him.
When he makes the titular Ratatouille.
Correct.
Yeah. And it's only the most transcendent scene in all of 21st century cinema.
And his lip quivers and he goes back into his childhood. That'll be you going back into your childhood, sharpening a
pencil shavings.
You probably don't remember pencil shavings the way Anton Ego remembers Ratatouille.
I literally don't remember pencil shavings. This is what I have been saying. I don't remember them.
Well, that's a you problem, not a the rest of the world problem.
I mean,
most of us know what pencil shavings smell like.
Looking at the timer on this recording, I think we're making it a lot of people's problem right now.
That is absolutely true. So that's what happens to red wine when it ages.
Oh my God. I opened this door and now I must step through it.
Yep. Absolutely.
All right, so aged white wine.
Aged white wine tends to gain color. The reasons for that is it's oxidizing, and the oxidation makes things brown, basically. The red wine loses color because there are anthocyanins that fall out of solution. And so they sort of both meet in the middle at brown.
All right, I'm going to take back everything I said earlier about you being a good communicator about wine, because meeting in the middle at brown is making me never want to open a bottle again.
Well, when they're fully brown, you can be pretty sure that they're dead and bad. But like a beautiful aged red wine will look lighter in color, but it'll have sort of like a tawny hue to it. A well-aged white wine will get golden and rich before it goes brown. White wines don't have tannin, so they don't have the issue of lessening in tannin. The fruit character changes in a very similar way. Ripe fruit and underripe fruit goes to like stewed and dried. Floral components go from fresh flowers to dried flowers. Earthiness and minerality become more prominent in the wine. And then oxidation gives you some nutty qualities as well. The real reason I chose Timeless is the stylistic quality of this wine. For sure, aging makes it, gives it a longer life, but that doesn't mean that it is ageless. I think that this particular style is ageless. I talked about the big extracted style of wines, and those we can put a date on. Those became very popular in the late 80s and became very dominant through the 90s.
Is this because of Robert Parker?
This is because of Robert Parker.
Step off, Robert Parker. All right. You've done enough damage. I've had to hear Jamie complain about you enough. Haven't you done enough to me, Robert Parker? Fucking turn it around, dog.
Robert Parker, have you thought about the damage that you have done to our poor, dear Scott Hudson?
I mean, I guess really my problem is with you more than with Robert Parker.
And then the backlash to that, the overripe, overwrought style, picking early, eschewing oak, being so afraid of overripeness that you ended up with underripeness and not fully developed flavors.
And that we're not in the backlash now, where this is post-backlash. Is this what this is coming from?
Right. All of these things do exist concurrently. There are still producers that err on the side of underripe, and there are still producers that err on the side of overripe. But this is the reaction to both reactions, and also the thing that has been there kind of all along. This is the style of wine that you could find from the 70s, the 60s, the 50s. It goes even farther back than that, but when it goes that far back, it's exclusively for noble people.
The landed gentry.
Right, because when you're getting that far back, most wine was just like throw grapes into a vat, allow it to ferment because we need to get drunk and also sometimes to kill bacteria in our water. I think this is the style that lives on. This is the one that, for lack of a better term, has legs. We don't need the extremes as much as we need something that just tastes good and is well-made, is purposeful, and also says something about the place that it comes from.
I'm going to put you on the spot here.
Yeah.
Do you have predictions for trends in the future? So like you think this wine will stand the test of time.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't mean that this will age well, but I mean you think that this style of winemaking is timeless.
Yes.
Do you think? This is a small production. This is not a trend-setting wine, right?
No, and also by its definition, trends are not frequently the middle of the road thing. They are the big, exciting overreaction. So do I think there will be a trend for wine like this? No, absolutely not. But it will always exist, and it'll always be what we return to after we're done being excited about the big dumb ones.
I'm a little drunk. I had two and a half glasses. I'm a little drunk.
You're drinking more this episode than you usually do.
I mean, this wine is just good. It's really good. Tasty, and I like filling it up. And also, there's more episode this episode.
There's a lot of episode. It seemed like you were going at a faster pace than usual.
It's a very drinkable wine.
It's good. It's approachable. It's youthful.
It's serious.
And it's timeless.
I don't know about timeless.
What do you think, Scott, about how this movie is timeless?
This movie, Greta Gerwig's 2019 Little Women.
Yes.
As you were saying with the wine, where there is a timelessness to it stylistically, and also there's a timelessness in that it will age very well. I think the movie has a timeless style, and there's a timelessness to the content and to the presentation of it, but that is not why I chose the movie either. Though I do think that, like the novel, this movie will live on for generations. But that's not why we're here. What I find timeless about it, and I touched on this a little bit earlier, is that the movie manages to feel both extremely authentic and accurate and faithful to the time period in which it is set, but also feels extremely modern and relevant and contemporary. That tension between the two things is what I find to be so timeless about it. There's this great Greta Gerwig quote from my version of the novel. I got the one with Saoirse Ronan on the cover. Not because I like to get the movie cover version that's normally goes against my code. I find that to be just like buying merchandise, but because it was the perfect middle ground in terms of price and also size of text.
Size of text being an important measure as we age.
Well, and just also like books where it's exhausting. Like, oh, I've been reading for 10 minutes and I read 3 pages because there's 800 words a page. Right. That's tiresome. I read slowly enough. I don't need a reminder from the print. Anyway, so there's this Greta Gerwig quote that is right inside the front cover here that I will read to you now. Louisa May Alcott, she was one of those people that I think pulled us into the next century. The 20th century was reaching down through her and giving her some ability to say, we're going to do this differently moving forward for women. So a lot of what Greta Gerwig has done in this adaptation is blending the text with the author's life.
Right. You mentioned this off mic. I find it fascinating. I'm sure I'll have more questions. Go on.
Starting with just how Greta got the job. It's 2016. She has heard that Sony Pictures is developing a remake of Little Women, or another adaptation of Little Women. She gets herself a meeting with at that time she was the head of Sony, Amy Pascal, who is this legendary producer and studio head. She has produced, among other things, like all of the Spider-Man movies, and she was the head of Sony, and she was very unfortunately the person at the top of Sony during the North Korea hack after the interview. And so all of her emails and dirty laundry were aired for the internet, and I'm sure it didn't help that she's a woman in Hollywood, and right. She just became an easy person for the axe to fall on. Anyway, Amy Pascal, but so Greta gets a meeting with her, and at that point she had been an actress for like 10 years, and she had co-written a few screenplays. She co-wrote 2 movies with her now partner, Noah Baumbach, who listeners of the show would know from our first episode, Marriage Story. At this point in her career, she had co-written with him Frances Ha and Mistress America, and she had written Lady Bird, but it had not yet been made into a feature. She gets this meeting, and this is what Amy Pascal says about Greta's take on it. She said, it was about how the ambition and the dreams that you have as a girl get stomped out of you as you grow up. It was about the kinds of conversations that we all have about commerce and art, and what we have to do to make things commercial.
Oof, that's a lot in a small amount of words.
It is a lot in a small amount of words, and it's all in the text. Like, it is all in the text, and it's just, these are the things that Greta Gerwig was most interested in. If you have seen Little Women, that is a movie that on the surface is a coming-of-age story for a young woman, but it is also about the struggles of a middle-class family. And she's very interested in the economics of family and the economics of being a woman. At first, she just pitched that she was going to write it, but she also knew that her take was going to be so fucking complex by blending the 2 timelines together that she always secretly hoped, like, man, if they approve this script, they have to hire me to direct it, because who else can make sense of this? Like, this is such a complicated take on it. But so what she ended up doing in trying to draw out the economic themes that are in the text is by blending Louisa May Alcott's actual biography into it. All the stuff with Joe about writing the actual novel, right? So like the movie includes Joe writing a novel, which is called The Little Women.
Yes.
All invented for the movie.
All invented for this movie.
For this movie.
Okay.
So in the book, when Joe, after Beth dies, gives up on her dreams of being a writer and throws all of her stories and her manuscripts in the fire, echoing the scene earlier when Amy burned up her manuscript. And then Aunt March dies and leaves Joe the house, and she turns it into a school. And then she gets married to Frederick, right?
Yep.
End of the book.
In this, she does all of that.
And right.
Also,
and also publishes a novel. And in her first meeting with the potential publisher, he says if the main character is a girl, she needs to be married or dead by the end of the story, which is something a publisher actually said to Louisa May Alcott.
It did have the ring of truth.
It for sure has the ring of truth to it. Alcott, she writes, just like Joe does in the movie, Joe writes the first 10 chapters of what becomes Little Women and sends it to the publisher. And he writes back to her and says, it's actually not very good, but like, send me more if you have. And just like in the movie, the actual publisher left it out and his nieces read those chapters and says, what happens? What happens to the Little Women? Which is how she gets this fucking book order. So she writes more. They publish the first half. And then when they make an agreement to publish a second half, the publisher forces on her this compromised ending where her main character, Joe, has to get married off. And Joe in the movie bristles about it, but ultimately compromises her art to get the thing fucking finished. Alcott described herself as being mercenary. I'm sure it pained her to take her character, Joe, who for the entirety of the story is tomboyish and independent and not interested in romance, and then having to pair her off with a man by the end of it. But she did it to get the thing published. Joe advocating for herself like Saoirse does at the end to keep the copyright to it is all stuff that Alcott actually had to do.
That's really cool.
It's super cool. And she blends these together without, like, she gets to have her cake and eat it too, right? Like, the movie ends with the big romantic thing where Joe chases down Frederick to the train station and they have a big kiss in the rain.
Yep.
And while they were filming it, Saoirse took Gerwig aside and she's like, hey, Greta, I know we've made like two movies together before, but like, doing like she chases the boy down to the train station and they have a big kiss in the rain. It really feels like we're making a movie now. And she doesn't look down on that. Like, there's no sense of disdain about the romantic ending where she gets paired off at the end. Gerwig said in, I think it was when she was interviewed by Jesse Thorne for Bullseye, she would be asked in Q&As like, well, what really happens? Like, does she get married like she does in the book and like you show in the movie? Or is that all this like fictional creation that is just for this new thing where you've added like biographically?
I had that thought.
Right. And Greta's answer was like, I can't fucking answer that question. Like, ontologically, I can't even wrap my brain around the question because it's all fiction. It's all fiction.
Right.
And the movie doesn't tip its hat either way. Like, the movie lets you enjoy it both ways, both as Joe struggling creatively to get her art out there while being also crushed by commerce and the expectations of what women's stories are, but also allows you to have this big, sweeping, beautiful, and very sincere romantic ending.
That part, the part where Joe is writing Little Women, which is so compelling, that the sequences of her writing, like, you feel her like feverish pursuit, like she's trying to just get it out of her.
She's like stacking pages and arrangements on the floor. Yep. You notice that she is ambidextrous. She keeps switching hands when one hand gets tired.
That was really cool.
So that's another autobiographical detail. The real Louisa May Alcott in when she was writing her earliest stories and she was still, I think she was like a seamstress or something. I don't have the appropriate vernacular for it, but like she would sew or knit all day for work for the family. And then at night she would write her stories. But to favor the hand that was tired, like she would switch and she would write with the other hand. She trained herself to be ambidextrous so that she could continue to pursue her writing.
Her writing, yeah. You know, that's a thing that they, not ambidextrosity.
Ambidexterity.
Ambidexterity.
Because dexterity is a word and ambi is a prefix.
That, yes. It's clearly been a long recording.
Oh my God.
In the like early 20th century, left-handedness was considered to be bad. And so they would force children to change to right-handedness. Mm-hmm. And that led to widespread dyslexia.
Really?
Yeah.
That led to dyslexia.
My father was 20 years my mother's senior. He was born in 1931 and was left-handed by birth and was forced through schooling to go right-handed and then was dyslexic the rest of his life.
Jesus, that is messed up.
It's the dumbest thing for people to fixate on, too.
Yeah, it doesn't actually matter.
Who gives a shit?
But yeah, the inflection or the infusion of Louisa May Alcott's actual biographical details and her struggles in the business of becoming a writer, by putting that into the book, it highlights stuff that's already in the text, right? Like, Joe is already struggling with assumptions about what women's stories are going to be. And assumptions about, well, you're a woman, you have to get married, and I don't want to get married. Amy in the text and in the movie wants to be an artist, but she also very clearly articulates that I want to be an artist, but I also want to marry wealthy. And there are certain expectations of me either way. Like that stuff is all in there. And by putting the autobiographical or the biographical stuff into it, she's just drawing that out and illuminating those themes even more, which for me is what makes it feel so, like I said, the tension, the timelessness of something that feels extremely contemporary and modern without betraying its roots in the 19th century.
It's adding. It's not, it doesn't feel like it's changing. Like it does, it feels contemporary because of the additions. It doesn't feel contemporary because, like you said earlier, it's not anachronistic in any way. It's obviously a period piece.
Yeah.
But the sensibilities are a little bit more modern, or at least are more vocally modern.
Yeah. And yet it's in the text. Like there are a number of moments in the movie that I felt like, oh, this is her putting 21st century like girl boss sensibility like into the words of these characters from 160 years ago. And it's like most of it is just straight up in the book. And the stuff that's not, apparently, she pulled from Alcott's letters and other like writings and personal
that's
correspondence.
So cool.
So like the author even gives her license to include more of the biographical stuff by making so much of the book based on her own childhood, like this rose-colored glasses version of her childhood, essentially.
Right.
Greta Gerwig has described her take on the movie and this blending of the fiction and the fact of the author's life and past and future as she described it two ways. One is that she described it as something as she wanted a kaleidoscopic view of authorship. So you get the sense of Alcott's voice as a narrator. It's not an omniscient third person narrator in the book. There's sometimes a first person quality to it. Like, oh, I tell you, dear reader, things like that.
Right.
She wanted to create the voice of the narrator in the book, telling a story based on that narrator's own life, but also the sense of Joe writing a book that is based on Alcott's life, which is not even in the text of the book. And then Greta Gerwig, a 21st century woman, is writing an adaptation based on that book and including a Joe character who is more closely modeled on the Alcott. She called it a kaleidoscope of authorship, and she also referred to it as cubist. Her take on it is cubist, the idea of all of these different angles and prisms and things that are like fractal and don't entirely line up, and the inclusion of biography and meta and two different timelines. Even the suggestion, and this did not fully click with me the first time I saw it. So the book starts with the first Christmas, right? The movie starts with Joe standing outside the publisher's office, kind of building up the courage to go in. By framing it that way, by starting with Joe pitching a story and having this dismissive publisher, played by Tracy Letts, telling her this is what women's stories are and this is what girls' stories are and that your character has to be married or dead by the end of it. By saying that, you put the marriage subplot as a plot device in the audience's mind. And now suddenly, not only does that ending, that like very meta constructed ending, become a thing where, like you were saying, we question, is this really happening or are we watching what Joe is telling? But now, because we start in the future and are flashing back to childhood and we know that Joe is writing these stories, we wonder, are these Joe's memories? Are these the stories that Joe is writing down? How much of this is truth? How much of this is her retelling the tale of it? And there is no conclusive answer to it. It's just part of the meta text of the movie. Like the movie is about authorship and about creation and about who owns and gets to tell their own stories. And it is just so much more infinitely complex than it might appear to you on the surface, because you might just look at it and say, this is a adaptation of a children's literature about young girls coming of age and getting married off. And like, it's so much more than that. It's so much more complicated.
And all of these other things. That's fascinating. I hadn't thought about the idea of the flashbacks possibly having being written by Joe. I'm going to have to do another watch through looking through that lens. And the kaleidoscope thing is kind of cool.
Yeah. Kaleidoscope of authorship and cubist.
I need to more fully understand what cubism is, I think, if I'm going to get on board with that.
Well, earlier in the episode, you mentioned pointillism in wine, and I did not put you on the spot to define that, so I refuse to be the one who has to answer what cubism is for you.
Cubism was a revolutionary new approach to representing reality invented in around 1907 to 08 by artists Pablo Picasso and George Braque. They brought different views of subjects, usually objects or figures, together in the same picture, resulting in paintings that appear fragmented and abstracted.
One of the most important pieces of Cubist art is, I think it's Marcel Duchamp's Nude Descending a Staircase, which is something that ended up becoming hugely influential for filmmakers later on. Jamie will Google it, and I'm sure we can share something. This movie is not visually Cubist, but it is narratively and like metatextually Cubist. But it's this amazing, like very, very geometric representation of a nude woman descending a staircase, but you're seeing like eight different versions of her in motion as she's coming down.
Yeah, this piece of art is insane. That's beautiful. Okay, I get it now. Well, the Cubist specific thing.
The Cubism.
The bringing together of multiple perspectives in the same image.
Right.
It seems like it's been adapted a number of times and is still thought of as a great piece of literature. Little Women, the book, I'm sure could be described as timeless.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Right.
I bet it even says it on, here we go, on the back. Discover Louisa May Alcott's timeless text.
The point that I was making, though, is the book already being timeless, there could have been a version of this movie that was just a representation of the novel, and it would...
There apparently have been several of them. Yeah.
Right, but using this kaleidoscope of authorship and this idea of cubism and buttressing the themes with other ideas and a 20th century sentiment, I think, is additive to that quality.
I concur. I concur with you agreeing with my original statements. James and the Giant Peach, are you ready for a special game of Wife Takes?
Is it a special game of Wife Takes?
You better believe it, buddy.
Oh, man.
This is top tier here. She did the work, as devout and faithful listeners of our show will know. This latest game is recreating my wife Tani's very favorite way to antagonize Jamie at his restaurants. I should note it's not her only way to antagonize Jamie at his restaurants.
She has myriad ways to antagonize me, regardless of the setting.
But especially at your restaurants where, you know, you're all puffed up and fucking wearing clashing patterns and shit and like
good.
A goddamn preening peacock. Admit,
I look good.
Somebody's got to bring you down. And since you're immune to my mockery, she got to step up once in a while.
That's
and I
true.
Appreciate her
she's
for that.
Way better at it than you are.
I mean, she's funnier and smarter than me.
That's correct.
It really helps. But so, her favorite way of antagonizing Jamie in a professional setting, she would come up with an absurdly pretentious and flowery description of the wine that he might serve us as a way to mock him and his delicate sommelier sensibilities. So each time we play this game, she will give me usually three descriptors of the wine, all of which are absurd and rooted in non-reality bullshit, and Jamie has to find out which ones are not rooted in her own actual experience of the wine. And another way of putting it is, Jamie, you got to sift the bullshit from the bullshit. You know what I'm saying?
I know exactly
right.
What you're saying.
Because it's all bullshit, but only one of them is bullshit.
Right, with the extra U's and L's.
That is correct. So, first round of Wife Takes this time is not Wife Takes.
What?
Child Takes.
Oh, dear God in heaven.
So, as hopefully none of you know, my precocious 5-year-old MB, and also my co-host on the other podcast that I'm working on, which is taking over the charts of father and child exploitative podcasts about movies and other random nonsense.
It's so cute.
It's super cute. I will not publish it anywhere because of internet. So my child, especially since Jamie and I have been doing this podcast, has, as children always do, they emulate what their parents do until they decide that they hate their parents and their parents aren't cool. And my son has not discovered that I'm not cool yet because he knows that we take wine seriously and we smell them and we try and take notes. Whenever I have a glass of wine at dinner, he will say, "Daddy, let me smell it." And then I'll hold it out and he'll take a sniff and he will say something adorable and precocious every time. So this is my wife's version of my child's takes on this wine, which I want to stress he has not drank and never will. And I'm really worried that one of these days the kindergarten teacher is going to bring me in for a conference and like, some says that he tries wine with you all the time. Which of the following is not a child take on the smell of Ant Hill Farms 2019 Sonoma Coast Pinot Noir?
Okay.
A, berries. B, berries, but also a little like a fart. C, regular old wine smell. Which of these is not a wife take based on a child take of this wine that my child has definitely not had to drink?
So I'm not actually trying to figure out what he's said. I'm trying to figure out what she is projecting.
This is all about her, because he has not, I think he probably has smelled this wine, but yeah, this is her thing. This is her game.
He did not have comments.
This is a cubist kaleidoscopic version of wife takes. That's right.
Beautiful. Wonderful tie-in. Okay. I'm going to go with berries, but also farts as the lie.
You are correct. The answer was B, berries, but also farts.
Yeah. It smells like berries, not like farts.
MB did actually describe the smell of this wine as his signature wine descriptor, regular old wine smell.
Regular old wine smell.
And I cannot disagree with him. I've been withholding that note for the last 4 hours because I didn't want to spoil the game here, but he's right. Regular old red wine smell.
Hard to disagree, but go on.
Okay, fine. It looks and tastes and smells like red wine in a good way.
I get it.
Next round. Second of two rounds. Jamie has won so far. This is actual wife takes. Which of the following is something that this wine evokes? A generalized sense of dismay. B, a sense of economic insecurity. C, regular old wine smell.
It's C. The answer is C, regular old wine smell.
The answer is C.
Yeah.
The answer is C. She telegraphed it by being too funny.
Yep.
She asked for the laugh, essentially. She gave it away.
And she got it. It's funny.
Yep. She does say that if Jamie answered A, incorrect, that's actually what the year 2021 evokes, a generalized sense of dismay.
And not untrue.
If Jamie answered B, incorrect, a sense of economic insecurity is what the movie Lady Bird evokes. Mm. But I also feel that this movie evokes a sense of economic insecurity.
And also I just have that general sense about myself all the time.
Right. It's definitely about you, Jamie. And then C, she says, you're correct. She's had a head cold for a week. She's taking MB's word on it. So Jim Jamborino.
Scotty, too hottie.
Do you think that this pairing works? I don't remember what we said because we talked about the pairing 4 glasses and 4 hours ago.
Slow your roll, because there's something we got to do first.
No, there isn't.
There is. There's a new game.
What?
There's a new game.
What? There's another game?
There's a new game sweeping the nation.
You had to wait for the 4 hour recording to add another game? So the audience has no idea about this, because I find that even though I think it's funny when we're recording the episodes to whine and complain that I'm a better co-host than you are because I keep coming up with games for you.
Yes.
And then when I listen to it later on, I realize that I just sound petty and whiny, so I cut it out. The audience has no idea that roughly 2 months ago, I promised me that you would make up another game.
And it took me this long.
Indeed. All right, another game.
A new game.
I am terrified and fascinated. All right.
It's going to be fun, I think, if very, very easy for you.
Okay, good.
So this new game is called Bad Reviews. Is it about the wine or about the movie?
Oh, this is good. I like this already. Good job, Jamie. Okay. Wait, but there like aren't any bad reviews of this movie. It's 95% on Rotten Tomatoes.
User reviews.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, fucking yeah. Put a gun in my mouth. User reviews of anything are, not to be a fucking elitist complaining about the internet.
They're
but
horrible.
They're the worst.
Which is why it's funny.
All right. Okay. So are these bad reviews of the wine or of the movie?
Or of the movie.
This is good. I'm impressed, Jamie. This is good.
Okay.
This is good co-host craft.
So number one, quote, young but good, needs to age, like most of my girlfriends, end quote.
I mean, that sounds like something disgusting that a user of Rotten Tomatoes or IMDb would say, but needs to age, that has to be the wine, right?
Correct. You are correct. This is Ravi Sidhu's 3.5 star review on Vivino.
Wow. Okay, so good. I'm glad to know that it's not just film like message boards and reviews that are rampant with disgusting, toxic misogyny, that it's also in the wine world as well.
That, oh yeah.
Wow, that is
extremely alive in the wine world.
Hang on, it's still catching up with me. Needs to age just like my girlfriend.
Like most of my girlfriends.
So gross.
Oh yeah, it's bad.
Even if he's joking, it's gross.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I'm repulsed. Okay, great. Moving on.
Okay, so the next one is a little bit of a high wire act. This person has little descriptions of his own actions in between the actual things that he has to say about the thing.
Okay.
So I'm going to redact the actual things that he has to say because they give it away.
But his, like, is he using like asterisks? Yes. Like early, like AOL chat room punctuation to indicate? Okay.
Exactly.
All right, great. This is terrible. Go on.
So he begins with one of those actions. Takes a sip of my bottle of Sprite. Then redacted. Notices mob advancing. Redacted. Shatters Sprite bottle against wall, holds glass at arm's length for protection. Redacted. Whips glass to and fro, but is knocked from my hand, leaving me defenseless. Redacted. Turns and runs away. As I run, I lose my pants around my ankles, exposing my bare bottom.
I mean, you're not giving me very much to work with here. What is this username? Is the username a spoiler?
Patrick.
I never met a Patrick I liked. I feel like that's a review of the movie, right? That somebody who's afraid of, in his mind, the woke mob of feminazis who are coming after him for not liking the lady movie about ladies.
That is correct. This is Patrick's 2.5 star review on Letterboxd.
On Letterboxd. So much of Letterboxd is a wonderful community. And then there's Patrick. Whew. Is that all? I've got three more. Oh boy. Okay, great.
Okay, next one. Ugh, didn't get it.
That's got to be the movie.
That is the movie. That's correct. The movie? Once again, correct.
Yep.
Nizflix R, 1.5 stars, Rotten Tomatoes.
Rotten Tomatoes. The scum of the earth are people who, who makes an account on Rotten Tomatoes?
I have no idea. Okay. Terrible. Thin. Sour. Never again.
That's the wine, right? The wine?
That is the wine. The wine. Yes, that's
thin,
correct.
Thin,
terrible,
sour,
thin,
never
sour,
again.
Never again. From Paolo Berard, 1 star, Vivino.
Paolo, that's not fair. Did you let this wine breathe? Did you decant it?
Did you even taste it?
You didn't hyper decant it, Paolo.
For sure.
You got to give it time. You got to get some oxygen in there, bud.
Okay, last one. It was never in 1 second be interesting and it's dumb.
Little Women and IMDb reviews.
We should add for the movie part. You get to guess.
That's a tricky part. Yeah.
Yes, correct. It is a movie review. It is Daniel S. Only a half a star, just a half star on Rotten Tomatoes.
On Rotten Tomatoes. Okay. Yeah. All right. Wow. Can you read that one to me again? Because I really want to make my blood boil right now.
It was never in 1 second be interesting, and it's dumb. Thank you, Daniel S., for your thoughtful, insightful, penetrating comments on 2019's Little Women.
Look. I get that there is a whole, like, audience of people who only want to watch Baby Yoda and fucking Marvel movies, and they only want to see big things with men who explode and make shit happen and fucking laser beams, pew, 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 CGI abs and shit. I get it. I have those base instincts as well. Don't tell me this movie isn't interesting. It's approachable.
This is going to be a good one because Scott's going to be upset by the end of every one of these games.
Well, the thing is that I used to be that guy who got mad online about people who had bad and wrong and wrong-headed takes on movies.
Right.
I have largely purged that out of my system.
You still get mad, but you don't do it on the internet because it doesn't help.
Well, I definitely don't shout into the void on the internet anymore. And if I tweet something, it's just because it's for my own amusement and also no one cares what I have to say. But then these things come out and I realize that it's still inside me to get mad. What is that guy's name again?
Daniel S.
Daniel S. on Rotten Tomatoes?
That's correct.
Half star rating?
Half star.
Go f*** yourself, Daniel, all right? You know what? Actually, no. Don't go f*** yourself. Get a good night's sleep because I know that high school starts really early in the morning and you're real tired and that you're just tired, and it's okay. You're young, and I don't know. I would say Boondock Saints or Scarface will be there for you tomorrow, but I'm sure that's not
what that was more of our era.
Yeah, I don't think that's what the young film kids like now.
What do you think this is an interesting one. What do you think the current standard issue dumb white guy? Because when we entered college, it was Scarface, Boondock Saints, Donnie Darko.
Scarface, Boondock Saints, Donnie Darko. I feel like less the poster than the movie, but right. Pulp Fiction or Reservoir yeah. Dogs.
We had
a Reservoir Dogs. We had Reservoir Dogs. Did we have a Pulp yeah. Fiction poster?
Yeah, we did.
Together?
You bought me the one of Samuel L. Jackson and John Travolta
yeah,
with the Jules, guns pointed.
Jules and Vincent with the guns.
That one was in my room.
Yeah, I got that at a college poster fair.
Anyway, so what do you think the current?
I don't know. I don't talk to young people. I don't know what young people like or what they watch. I clearly stay off the fucking internet. Like, I don't talk to these people. My assumption is just Star Wars and Marvel movies.
Yeah,
because the type of like toxic and hostile like male self-importance about the movies like your Scarfaces and Pulp Fictions and Fight Clubs from 20 years ago.
Oh, all Fight Club. I forgot about Fight
yeah.
Club too. Fuck.
All of that toxicity has now calcified around children science fiction entertainment. Heaven forbid yeah. you say anything bad about Baby Mando or, you know, say that the MCU isn't the greatest genre smashing cinematic experiment in the history of film.
Do you think there's one Marvel movie above them all that is like the like penetrating, pervasive? Like-
oh, it's I think it's Captain America, the Winter Soldier. People okay. fucking love jacking off about, they just love parroting back what the marketing ploy for that movie was, which is like, oh, well, actually, we really wanted to make more like a 70s paranoia thriller, like The Parallax View or All the President's Men. And then you watch the movie and you're like, oh, no, it's just a Marvel movie that has a little bit of suspicion and Robert Redford in it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The fucking subversive, toxic male people from 20 years ago. Now they just want to, you know, suck the dick of the biggest brand, which happens to be Mickey Mouse.
Uh-huh.
All right, Jamie, thank you very much. That was delightful. I like having the spotlight on me in a while. That was fun. That was a good game. That was really good.
I'm glad you liked it.
That was great. You got to up the difficulty next time, but was good.
Dude, it's hard. There are like...
Wait, are you saying that there's not a lot of crossover between the ways that people talk about wine and the way that people talk about Little
there
Women?
There is none. There is no crossover.
So... The pairing. We've already said several ages of Middle Earth ago what we thought of the pairing. You don't have a take on the pairing. You think that it's a good pointillistic pairing. They're good separately.
That's what I think. Or at least that was my take as I was watching the movie and drinking the wine. This is a thing that some sommeliers will do in fine dining restaurants where wine pairings are offered.
You just cheat.
We cheat, right. So like... If there's a dish that is particularly difficult to pair with, what we'll do is just choose a superlatively good wine, and they'll go together because the dish is good and the wine is good, and people will love it, and it's fine or whatever.
That seems reasonable, especially since I imagine many of the people coming to your restaurants couldn't identify a good pairing from like, you know, a hole in the ground.
Well, there's also that.
Yeah, you give them two good things together is still two good things.
Exactly. But that's how I feel about this wine in this movie. I've been pretty effusive about this wine. I fucking love it. I think it's great. And I think that this movie is really, really stellar as well. And I think that, you know, the pleasant experience of drinking this wine and the pleasant experience of watching this movie are pleasant together. You have something more specific, though.
Well, yeah. I mean, not being a plebeian Philistine like you, Jamie, I actually come to the pairing section with thoughtful things to say. As anyone who listened to
to all of our previous episodes where you came to the pairing section with, I don't know.
I did pretty well, except for last time when I believe it was just static when it came to the pairing previously. My biggest take, even not being able to, like, you can see I have far fewer notes on my little gift from Madeline Plouquet here.
Not a gift, you bought it.
But yeah, in my Wine Folly tasting notes, I have far fewer than I have recently because, again, I have like blinkers on for red wine and I don't understand things and couldn't describe it. But even then, while drinking it, I had this like strong take that it is actually a perfect pairing.
Huh.
Well, because the fruit, those like big, bold red wine fruity flavors are the past. They're the joy and the warmth. And you said that there's no sugar, but that I was detecting sugar or the illusion of sugar because of the fruit.
Because we associate those flavors with sweet things. Right. Yes.
So the fruit is the past. The fruit is the rose-colored glasses. The fruit is all the girls piled up around Laura Dern's lap at Christmas time. The fruit is warmth and happiness and hearth and home. And the tannins, while not overwhelming in this wine, the tannins are the bitter, astringent reality of the future. The tannins are fucking Amy laying it out for Timmy Cham Cham and telling it like it is, where she's like, well, I think we have some choice in who we fall in love with. And he's like, oh, I think the poets would disagree. And then she just fucking bodies him and leaves a fucking Timmy Cham Cham hole in the ground.
It's true. She does.
That's the tannin for me. The tannin is the realities of adulthood, and especially the adulthood for these women, the dryness and the difficulty. And then all the fruit is them looking back, or maybe Joe looking back on the easier times of childhood when things weren't as complicated and when they were more palatable and easy.
Maybe to extend your metaphor, the baking spice character also calls to the sort of autumnal warmth of the past.
Yeah. Autumn in New England, autumn in Concord, Massachusetts.
I like your take on that.
Yeah. I made a really good pairing here that was definitely on purpose and certainly not an accident.
It was 100% on purpose. That's canon. We're closing the book on that.
We cannot have canon on the show. There cannot be canon.
What do you think about a double feature for this movie?
A little bit of a double feature.
Right. We've just watched Little Women. What's next?
You got to watch 2020 David Copperfield. So this is based on the beloved 19th century Dickens novel. It is written and directed by Armando Iannucci, he of In the Loop and Veep fame.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and it's Armando Iannucci with his like acerbic, caustic sensibility doing a surprisingly straight and sincere and warm version of David Copperfield that is race-blind casting. So the great and wonderful Dev Patel plays David Copperfield. A bunch of the other roles are filled out with persons of color, but it is just like this movie. It is a modern and seemingly, I say seemingly because I'm an illiterate and I've never read any of the great works of the Western or any other literary canon.
I deeply empathize with that.
Right, because Jamie can't read. I can read. I just choose not to. Therefore, I am probably the villain here.
F*** you, buddy.
It is seemingly a very faithful adaptation that, like, this movie is very contemporary, and the big contemporary swing here is just like, fuck it, they didn't have cameras and score when everybody was running around in the 19th century, so why can't they be brown people? It's effortless, and like this movie, it's effervescent, and there's a lot of joy, and it's so much fun and so meta in the construction of the story, and the fucking cast on this movie.
I mean, you already told me about Dev Patel, who I very much like.
Dev Patel, who we love. Dev Patel, star of like my favorite movie of this year. Well, my second favorite movie of this year after the Matrix Resurrections trailer, which is, of course, David Lowery's exquisite The Green Knight. But so, you got your Dev Patel, Peter Capaldi, Ben Whishaw, Tilda Swinton, Gwendolyn Christie, Hugh Laurie, Benedict Wong. The Dev Patel performance is amazing. Everybody's great in it. Capaldi and Hugh Laurie and Swinton are hysterical, but it's just gorgeous. And it's the most fun I've had with anything all year. And it's a victim of it being a 2020 movie, and so fucking nobody saw it. Armando Iannucci's David Copperfield, I think, would be a perfect pairing for this movie. They are kind of a piece with each other, even though they're very different in their sensibilities. That, as of this recording, is on the HBO Max. And, yo, check it out, y'all. It's so much fucking fun.
This sounds like something that I very much want to watch.
As I often say, as I know you very well, it's an extremely Jamie movie.
Yes.
Not an extremely goofy movie, but an extremely Jamie movie.
Right. Jamie also is pretty goofy.
All right. So, an extremely Jamie double feature. Let's say people are enjoying this Pinot Noir. What do you serve them? What are you slinging at the bar for your one night a week now?
If they want to try another look at Pinot Noir.
Pinot Noir. It's been 3 hours since I've done that. You thought I forgot? Pinot Noir.
I did not think you forgot. Don't, just stop it. Pinot Noir. It's making me very uncomfortable. I don't like it.
Jamie doesn't like the deep bassy register that I'm able to achieve with very little effort.
I don't like it at all.
Yep.
It's not good.
When I go
it's
and bad. Edit the show later on, I have to basically take bass out of my EQ and add it to Jamie's so that we both sound like normal adult men.
So the wine.
Ooh, I'm drunk.
Okay.
We have to get some dinner so I can drive home later.
Yes. Next wine after Anhill Farms. If you're looking for a different lens on Pinot Noir, coming from the Finger Lakes is Nathan K. Pinot Noir. Nathan K. is a label created by Nathan Kendall. Originally, the label was N. Kendall until he got sued by Kendall Jackson, which is obnoxious.
That can't possibly have any legal ground.
Well, so it doesn't, I don't think, but he's such a small producer and they are so huge
he
that
he couldn't
for
afford
him,
to fight it.
He couldn't afford to fight it.
That is you, Kendall Jackson.
Yes.
Jamie, give me some ammunition against Kendall Jackson right now.
I actually was having a discussion with a friend last night about how good Kendall Jackson Vintners Reserve, they're like massively mass-produced Chardonnay.
They're Chardonnay. You actually, you're a defender of KJ Chardonnay.
I am.
I recall this.
KJVR, it's fucking good. I'm sorry, wine people who want to slam dunk on it. Like, it's delicious wine, and I will die on that hill. However, the actions of a corporate entity against a very small time producer, fucking indefensible.
How do you, it's his name.
It's his name.
It's his name. It's your name. F you, Kendall Jackson.
I completely agree.
I'm never buying KJ Chardonnay ever again.
I still have a bottle of his wine that's labeled N. Kendall. I think it's the 2013 Chardonnay that I've got downstairs.
That is messed up. Not yeah. that you have it. That's the lawsuit.
That the lawsuit
that is passed up from the Cavs
it,
up.
It is
unacceptable.
Yes. So Nathan Kendall makes this wine. He also makes wine for his family's winery, Hickory Hollow. Then his private label is Nathan Kendall, and he has a partnership with Pascaline LePeltier, Master Sommelier, to make another project called Chapika. But the Nathan K. Pinot Noir, it's a take on Pinot Noir from a guy who was born and raised in the Finger Lakes, but then has worked in Burgundy and New Zealand. Both notable for their production of great Pinot Noir. So you can feel the impact of those things, of that perspective on this wine. It's certainly more austere than the Anhill Farms, partly because it comes from a cooler climate, but also partly because Nathan, I think, is emphasizing that aspect of it. We've said laser beam acidic on this podcast a bunch. It's sharp. It's cutting. It's a little biting. It definitely requires food. And requires thought and introduction in a way that Anthill doesn't. But if you find yourself charmed by Anthill Farms and want to know more about Pinot Noir, I think the Nathan K is your next step, or could be a very good next step into understanding the grape. You can get this wine from the Hickory Hollow website. All of the ordering is streamlined through that website. There isn't a separate one for Nathan K or N. Kendall, if you choose to call it that.
And I do.
$32.95 for Nathan K.
Nathan K's Pinot Noir.
Available at hickoryhollow.com. It's fucking delicious. Buy it. And also, like, the Hickory Hollow wines are even more affordable and still made by this guy who is extremely skilled and thoughtful in his winemaking. And he just released a Blaufränkisch that I'm very excited to buy some of. Okay, guys, next time on. This will be the final installment of Jamie's History of American Wine.
Jamie's History of American Wine.
That's correct.
That's right. The Pledge of Jamie Legions. we're closing it in. I definitely have a good understanding of the history of American wine, having concluded 5 episodes so far of preventing you from talking about it at all.
Well, it's a podcast about movies and wine.
And yeah, well,
we just talked about the movie.
Next time, we're bringing it home.
Yes.
The history of American wine is coming to a conclusion.
Yep.
Just as the history of the American Empire and the history of human life on this here earth is slowly winding down.
Just stop it.
I'm just telling it like it is, baby. I'm just telling it like it is.
And don't call me baby.
You called me honey, I'll call you baby.
I guess that's fair. The last wine in this miniseries is Cruz Wine Company Monkey Jacket Valdigay Blend from North Coast, California, 2018. It is available at Astor Wine and Spirits for $25.
I like many of the words that you used to just name that wine.
Monkey Jacket.
Monkey Jacket. And what was the other thing you said?
Valdigay.
Valdigay. Valdigay is just fun to say out loud.
It is.
Yeah.
It's a good grape too. Tasty.
So Jamie, whoa. what did you tell me about this wine to maybe, you know, spur on some kind of creative pairing situation?
This one is more abstract than really any of them.
What? Abstraction?
Okay, so the words that I gave you controlled chaos, I gave you sunny, take it as it comes, and tales of place.
Controlled chaos, sunny, take it as it comes, and tales of place. So this took me immediately to one of my favorite movies of the last few years. We're not doing a 2019 film. We're not doing a 2020 film.
And we're not doing a 2017 film.
We're going into the deep, dark recesses of the forgotten past of the year 2018. We will be talking about Chloe Jaws, 2018. I think fucking stunning second feature, The Rider. This is from Chloe Jaw, she who recently won Oscars for Nomadland earlier this year. She is directing the upcoming Marvel movie, The Eternals, which is the only upcoming Marvel movie that looks even remotely interesting and like it has an identity or point of view behind the camera. But I don't really care about that because I fucking love The Rider. It is a beautiful and lovely and lyrical movie that is filled with non-professional actors playing loosely fictionalized versions of themselves. The lead actor is a non-professional actor named Brady Jandrew. He plays a character named Brady Blackburn. Both Bradys were rodeo cowboys who were thrown from a horse, suffered a concussion, and were told by their doctors, if you ever ride again, you risk permanent brain damage and death. And the real Brady and the fictional Brady struggle with how do you incorporate that change into your life when riding has been your soul and your purpose and your means of providing for yourself and your family. It is lyrical. It is semi-improvised. It feels natural and of the earth, and the landscape is a huge part of it. And it is so touching and so gorgeous. And I really urge people to seek it out. It's not available streaming fucking anywhere as of the moment. Do your rental. I got my copy from the library when I first saw it. Seriously, check it out. I think people will love it. And as we are often advocates for, it is a 100-minute movie.
Oh, we love it.
And while it's not an 80-minute movie, it is a 100-minute movie. And I'm a big fan. The Rider. Chloe Jaw. Brady Jandrew. Check it out. I'm afraid of horses, and I have to advocate people watching a movie where horses are a threat. And I think, honestly, that kind of, you know, puts some ammunition in my holster there.
I don't know why you're afraid of horses. It's the dumbest. And no, it's reasonable. They're huge. We don't have to litigate this right now.
Check back in with me after you've watched The Rider, Jamie, and then tell me that it's unreasonable to be afraid of horses. Watch the movie.
Because, okay, I'm going to watch the movie. I'm obligated to watch the movie.
That is correct. All right. Jim Jamborino, land the plane.
Thank you so much for joining us. Please, if you have it in you, follow us on the socials at BiggerBottlePod. If you have any questions or concerns, email us at BiggerBottlePod@gmail.com. Make sure you give us a rate, review, and follow wherever you get your podcasts. And the best place you can do that is Apple Podcasts, because they have an outsized influence on the success of shows.
That is correct. Listen where you listen, but please leave that review on the Apple Pods, and we will read it on the air. This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That is me. Our social media presence is thanks to the illustrious James Jamie Harrison Rubin. That's him right over there. You guys can't see me pointing.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you, we promise.
And as I must confess, I'm a little bit drunk. Good night, everyone.
Love y'all.
Oh my God.
What kind of monsters are we?
I blame you, but also me.
Absolutely your fault.
It is half my fault.
And half my fault.
And half your fault.
That's fair. I'm going to drink more of this wine.
As am I.
Beautiful.